think that the FBI is going to suddenly start following your orders. It's not going to happen. He's not competent. And that's the point at which Mr. Clark tried to defend himself by saying, well, I've been involved in very significant civil and environmental litigation. I've argued many appeals and appellate courts and things of that nature. And then I pointed out that, yes, he was an environmental lawyer. And
welcome to the Nicole Sandler Show. We're just going to carry this hearing for as long as it goes.
United States Justice Department.
Did anybody in there support Mr. Clark?
No one.
Mr. Rosen, it was you he was going to replace. So what was your view about the president's plan to appoint Mr. Clark?
Well, as I alluded to earlier, the issue really wasn't about me. It would have been fine, as I said, to have had Rich Donahue replace me. I would have said, great, I get 17 days vacation or something. But the issue was the use of the Justice Department. And it's just so important that the Justice Department adhere to the facts and the law. That's what it's there to do. And that's what our constitutional role was. And so if the Justice Department gets out of the role that it's supposed to play, that's really bad for our country. And I don't know of a simpler way to say that. And when you damage our fundamental institutions, it's not easy to repair them. So I thought this was a really important issue to try to make sure that the Justice Department was able to stay on the right course.
Mr. Donahue, did you eventually tell the president that mass resignations would occur if he installed Mr. Clark and what the consequences would be?
Yes. So this was in line with the president saying, what do I have to lose? Along those lines, he said, so suppose I do this. So suppose I replace him, Jeff Rosen, with him, Jeff Clark. What would you do? And I said, Mr. President, I would resign immediately. I'm not working 1 minute for this guy, who I just declared was completely incompetent. And so the president immediately turned to Mr. Engel, and he said, Steve, you wouldn't resign, would you? And he said, absolutely, I would, Mr. President. You leave me no choice. And then I said, and we're not the only ones. No one cares if we resign. If Steve and I go, that's fine. It doesn't matter. But I'm telling you what's going to happen. You're going to lose your entire department leadership. Every single AAG will walk out on you. Your entire department leadership will walk out within hours. And I don't know what happens after that. I don't know what the United States attorneys are going to do. We have U.S. attorneys in districts across the country. And my guess would be that many of them would have resigned. And that would then have led to resignations across the department in Washington. And I said, Mr. President, within 24, 48, 72 hours, you could have hundreds and hundreds of resignations of the leadership of your entire Justice Department because of your actions. What's that going to say about you?
Wow. Mr. Engel, can you describe what your reaction was to that?
I think when the president, my recollection is that when the president turned to me and said, Steve, you wouldn't leave, would you? I said, Mr. President, I've been with you through four attorneys general, including two acting attorney general, but I couldn't be part of this. And then the other thing that I said was that, all anyone is going to sort of think about when they see this, no one is going to read this letter. All anyone is going to think is that you went through two attorneys general in 2 weeks until you found the environmental guy to sign this thing. And so the story is not going to be that the Department of Justice has found massive corruption that would have changed the result of the election. It's going to be the disaster of Jeff Clark. And I think at that point, Pat Cipollone said, yeah, this is a murder-suicide pact, this letter.
And I would note, too, Congressman, that it was in this part of the conversation where Steve pointed out that Jeff Clark would be left leading a graveyard, and that comment clearly had an impact on the president. The leadership will be gone. Jeff Clark will be left leading a graveyard.
Again, the premise that, which as Mr. Donahue has said, but that Mr. Clark could come in and take over the Department of Justice and do something different was just an absurd premise. And all he was doing, Mr. Clark, by putting himself forward, was blowing himself up. And, if the president were to have gone that course, it would have been a grievous error for the president as well.
Mr. Cipollone, the White House counsel, told the committee that Mr. Ingalls' response had a noticeable impact on the president, that this was a turning point in the conversation. Mr. Donahue, towards the end of this meeting, did the president ask you what was going to happen to Mr. Clark?
He did. When we finally got to the, I would say, the last 15 minutes of the meeting, the president's decision was apparent. He announced it. Jeff Clark tried to scrape his way back and asked the president to reconsider. The president doubled down, said, no, I've made my decision. That's it. We're not going to do it. And then he turned to me and said, so what happens to him now? Meaning Mr. Clark. And he understood that Mr. Clark reported to me. And I didn't initially understand the question. I said, Mr. President, and he said, are you going to fire him? And I said, I don't have the authority to fire him. He's a Senate-confirmed assistant attorney general. And he said, well, who has the authority to fire him? And I said, only you do, sir. And he said, well, I'm not going to fire him. I said, all right, well, then we should all go back to work.
Did you get a call from the president later that night?
I did, I don't know, probably 90 minutes later or something like that.
What was that about?
The president, at this point, we left the White House, reconvened at the department. I left the department. I was back in my apartment. My cell phone rang. It was the president, and he had information about a truck supposedly full of shredded ballots in Georgia that was in the custody of an ICE agent whose name he had. I told him that ICE was part of Department of Homeland Security. I hadn't heard about this. If Department of Homeland Security needed our assistance, we, of course, would provide it. But it was really up to DHS to make a call if their agent was involved. And he said, fine, I understand. Can you just make sure that Ken, meaning Ken Cuccinelli, knows about this? I said, fine, I would pass that along to him. I eventually contacted Ken Cuccinelli later that evening, and I said, this is what the president told me. If you guys have anything you think should be brought to our attention, let me know. And he said, thank you, and that was it.
Mr. Cipollone left the meeting convinced the president would not appoint Mr. Clark, but he didn't think the president had actually accepted the truth about the election. Sure enough, all the same debunked theories appeared in his speech at the Ellipse 3 days later.
In the state of Arizona, over 36,000 ballots were illegally cast by non-citizens. 11,600 more ballots and votes were counted, more than there were actual voters. You see that? In Wisconsin, corrupt Democrat-run cities deployed more than 500 illegal, unmanned, unsecured drop boxes, which collected a minimum of 91,000 unlawful votes.
Mr. Donahue, Mr. Rosen, Mr. Engel, and others stopped President Trump's efforts, at least temporarily. Yet the message President Trump and his Republican allies pushed throughout December made its way to his supporters anyway. And they kept up the pressure campaign on the way to storming the Capitol on January 6th. Mr. Rosen, were you at the Department of Justice on January 6th?
Yes, I was there all day.
Once the Capitol was under attack, I understand that you communicated with fellow cabinet members and Capitol Hill leadership. Can you tell us who you spoke to?
Yeah, I was basically on the phone virtually nonstop all day. Some calls with our own DOJ folks, some with cabinet counterparts at DHS and defense and the interior, some with senior White House officials, and with a number of congressional leaders. I received calls from Speaker Pelosi, from Leader McCarthy, from Leader Schumer, I believe Leader McConnell's chief of staff called, a number of other members of Congress as well. And the basic thrust of the calls with the members of Congress was, there's a dire situation here, and can you help? And I reported to them that we were, on a very urgent basis, sending help from the department. We wound up sending over 500 agents and officers from FBI, ATF, and the U.S. Marshals to assist with restoring order at the Capitol. So had a number of calls. As I say, it was more or less nonstop all afternoon.
Did you speak to the vice president that day?
Yes, twice.
No, please, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, the first call was a one-on-one discussion, somewhat akin to the congressional leadership calls, updating him on what we were doing to assist. And the second call was a conference call around 7 o'clock with the vice president, congressional leaders, senior White House staff, some other cabinet officials, to address that order appeared to be close to being restored, but security still being determined, and the question being what time could the Congress reassemble, and the answer was 8 o'clock, and thankfully Congress did reassemble and complete its constitutional duty. There was one highlight of that second call with the Vice President, which is Mr. Donahue had gone to the rotunda of the Capitol to be able to give firsthand account and was able to tell the folks on the call, including the Vice President, that we thought 8 o'clock would work.
Did you speak to the President on January 6th?
No, I spoke to a number of senior White House officials, but not the president.
Mr. Donahue, on January 6th, we know from Mr. Rosen that you helped in the effort to reconvene joint session, the joint session, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
We see here in a video that we're going to play now, you arriving with your security detail to help secure the Capitol. Mr. Donahue, 30 minutes after you arrived to the Capitol, did you lead a briefing for the Vice President?
I'm not sure exactly what the time frame was, but I did participate in the call and participate in briefing the Vice President as well as the congressional leadership that night, yes.
Now, where'd you conduct that call at?
I was in an office. I'm not entirely sure where it was. My detail found it because of the acoustics in the rotunda were such that it wasn't really conductive to having a call. So they found an office. We went to that office, and I believe I participated in two phone calls, one at 1800 and one at 1900 that night from that office.
What time did you actually end up leaving the Capitol?
I waited until the Senate was back in session, which I believe they were gaveled in a few minutes after 8 p.m., and once they were back in session and we were confident that the entire facility was secured and cleared, that there were no individuals hiding in closets or under desks, that there were no IEDs or other suspicious devices left behind, I left minutes later. I was probably gone by 8:30.
And Mr. Donahue, did you ever hear from President Trump that day?
No. Like the AAG, the acting AG, I spoke to Pat Cipollone and Mark Meadows and the Vice President and the congressional leadership, but I never spoke to the President that day.
So in today's hearing, we've showcased the efforts of the Americans before us to stand up for democracy. Mr. Rosen, Mr. Donahue stayed steadfastly committed to the oath they take as officials in the Department of Justice. On January 6th itself, they assisted during the attack while our Commander-in-Chief stayed silent. Their bravery is a high moment in the sordid story of what led to January 6th. My colleagues also take an oath. Some of them failed to uphold theirs and instead chose to spread the big lie. Days after the tragic events of January 6th, some of these same Republican members requested pardons in the waning days of the Trump administration. 5 days after the attack on the Capitol, Representative Mo Brooks sent the email on the screen now. As you see, he emailed the White House, quote, pursuant to a request from Matt Gaetz, requesting a pardon for Representative Gaetz himself and unnamed others. Witnesses told the Select Committee that the President considered offering pardons to a wide range of individuals connected to the President. Let's listen to some of that testimony.
And was Representative Gaetz requesting a pardon?
Believe so. The general tone was, we may get prosecuted because we were defensive of, you know, the President's positions on these things. The pardon that he was discussing, requesting, was as broad as you could describe. From the beginning, I remember he's from the beginning of time up until today, for any and all things. He mentioned Nixon, and I said Nixon's pardon was never nearly that broad.
And are you aware of any members of Congress seeking pardons? guess Mr. Gates and Mr. Brooks, I know, both advocated for there'd be a blanket pardon for members involved in that meeting and a handful of other members that weren't at the December 21st meeting as the preemptive pardons. Mr. Gates was personally pushing for a pardon, and he was doing so since early December. I'm not sure why. Mr. Gates had reached out to me to ask if he could have a meeting with Mr. Meadows about receiving a presidential pardon.
Did they all contact you?
Not all of them, but several of them did.
So you mentioned Mr. Gates, Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Biggs did. Mr. Jordan talked about congressional pardons, but he never asked me for one. It was more for an update on whether the White House is going to pardon members of Congress. Mr. Gomer asked for one as well. Mr. Perry asked for a pardon too. I'm sorry, I need to finish.
Mr. Perry, did he talk to you directly?
Yes, he did.
Did Marjorie Jovine contact you?
No, she didn't contact me about it. I heard that she had asked White House Counsel Office for a pardon from Mr. Philbin, but I didn't frequently communicate with Ms. Green.
Are you aware of any conversations or communications regarding the possibility of giving Congressman Matt Gaetz a pardon?
I know he had asked for it, but I don't know if he ever received one or what happened with it.
How do you know that Congressman Gaetz asked for a pardon?
He told me.
Tell us about that.
He told me he'd asked Meadows for a pardon.
Were you involved in or did you witness any conversations about the possibility of a blanket pardon for everyone involved in January 6th?
I had heard that mentioned, yeah.
Do you know whether the president had any conversations about potentially pardoning any family members?
I know he had hinted at a blanket pardon for the January 6th thing for anybody, but I think he had for all the staff and everyone involved, not with January 6th, but just before he left office, I know he had talked about that.
The only reason I know to ask for a pardon is because you think you've committed a crime. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
I want to thank our witnesses for joining us today. The members of the Select Committee may have additional questions for today's witnesses, and we ask that you respond expeditiously in writing to these questions. Without objection, members will be permitted 10 business days to submit statements for the record, including opening remarks and additional questions for the witnesses. Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentleman from Illinois for a closing statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Justice Department lawyers are not the president's personal lawyers. We count on them to be on the side of the law and to defend the best interest of the United States, not the best interest of any political campaign. That's how it's been since the department was founded soon after the Civil War. Justice Department lawyers are supposed to play it 100% straight. President Trump tried to erase his loss at the ballot box by parachuting an unqualified man into the top job at Justice. It was a power play to win at all costs with no regard for the will of the American people. It was about ignoring millions of votes. Ignore them, throw them out, label them fraudulent, corrupt, illegal, whatever. Facts were clearly just an inconvenience. From the Oval Office, President Trump urged others to bring his big lie to life. He begged, just say the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressmen. He didn't care what the department's investigations proved. What good were facts when they would only confirm his loss? And it's no surprise that all the far-out, fully fabricated, whack job conspiracy theories collapsed under even the slightest scrutiny. That insanity went from the internet to the highest levels of government in no time. The bottom line, the most senior leadership of the Justice Department, from Attorney General Bill Barr to Jeff Rosen, his successor and his deputy Rich Donahue, everyone except Jeff Clark, was telling President Trump the very same thing. The conspiracy theories were false. The allegation of a stolen election was a lie. The data left no room for doubt, nothing to question. And the Constitution left no room for President Trump to change the outcome of the election. But we're here today because the facts were irrelevant to President Trump. It was about protecting his very real power and very fragile ego, even if it required recklessly undermining our entire electoral system by wildly casting baseless doubt upon it. In short, he was willing to sacrifice our republic to prolong his presidency. I can imagine no more dishonorable act by a president. We owe a great debt of gratitude to these men you've heard from here today. Real leaders who stood for justice when it was in grave peril, who put their country first when the leader of the free world demanded otherwise. They threatened to resign rather than corrupt our democracy. And thanks largely to each of them, President Trump's coup failed. Contrast that to Jeff Clark, who would do exactly what the president wanted. Say there was massive fraud, forget the facts, and leave the rest to President Trump's congressional friends. Mr. Clark refused to cooperate with this committee. He pled the fifth over 125 times. Why risk self-incrimination? And President Trump's congressional friends, some of them are angling for pardons. They knew that every bit of what they did was a lie and it was wrong. That's all the more reason to respect those who came here to testify today. We thank them for their unflinching service in the face of incredible pressure. As it's said, the only thing necessary for evil to succeed is good men to do nothing. Thankfully, there were good people in the Department of Justice. You heard from other good people, too, on Tuesday. They, too, defended us. But I'm still worried that not enough has changed to prevent this from happening again. The oath that we take has to mean something. It has to cut to the core of who we are and be the driving force of our service to this nation. We on this committee, we may be able to shine light on the darkness, but that is not enough. It's now up to every American, now and in the future, to stand for truth, to reject the lies wherever we confront them, in our towns, in our capitals, in our friendships, in our families, and at the ballot box, and within our own minds and hearts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Without objection, the chair recognizes the gentlewoman from Wyoming, Ms. Cheney, for a closing statement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And I again want to thank the witnesses for being here today. After today, I suspect that there will be some who label you agents of the deep state or nonsensical, meant to justify ignoring what you've said today, ignoring the facts. That may be the short-term cost of acting honorably and telling the truth. But your actions should have an important long-term impact. They will help keep us on the course set by the framers of our Constitution. Let me paraphrase the words of John Adams and others. Whether ours shall continue to be a government of laws and not of men is ultimately for the American people to decide. And let me also today make a broader statement to millions of Americans who put their trust in Donald Trump. In these hearings so far, you've heard from more than a dozen Republicans who've told you what actually happened in the weeks before January 6th. You will hear from more in the hearings to come. Several of them served Donald Trump and his administration, others in his campaign. Others have been conservative Republicans for their entire careers. It can be difficult to accept that President Trump abused your trust, that he deceived you. Many will invent excuses to ignore that fact. But that is a fact. I wish it weren't true, but it is. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Again, I thank our witnesses and thank my colleagues for this hearing. As we conclude our fifth hearing in this series, I want to remind the American people of a few things the committee has shown. Donald Trump lost the 2020 election. Top Republican officials who supported Trump knew that he lost and told him he lost. Trump knew he lost. Those who say the election was affected by widespread voter fraud are lying. They were lying in 2020, they were lying in 2021, and indeed, they are lying today. Donald Trump went to court. That's the right any candidate seeking to challenge the outcome of an election must do. Donald Trump lost in court dozens and dozens of times. He lost in part because there was no evidence that voter fraud had any impact on the results of the election. To borrow a phrase from our witness earlier this week, Mr. Bowers, all he had was theories and no evidence. As I've said, if you're running for office in the United States, that's the end of the line. You accept the court's judgment, you concede the race, you respect the rule of law, and the will of the voters. But for Donald Trump, that wasn't the end of the line, not even close. The voters refused to keep him in office. The courts refused to keep him in office, but he continued to lie, and he went in search of anyone who would go along with his scheme. And we've shown today, he pressured the Justice Department to act as an arm of his reelection campaign. He hoped law enforcement officials would give the appearance of legitimacy to his lies, so he and his allies had some veneer of credibility when they told the country that the election was stolen. Earlier this week, we showed how Donald Trump brought the weight of the presidency down on local and state officials who are trying to do their jobs, and ultimately did. They investigated his claims and found them to be false. And then they endured Trump's pressure campaign at great risk to themselves and their loved ones. And of course, there was a scheme to get the former Vice President, Mike Pence, to violate the law and the Constitution by rejecting the Electoral College votes on January 6th and blocking the peaceful transfer of power. I mentioned the former Vice President last because, as we showed, when he refused to bow to the pressure in those critical moments on January 6th, there was a backup plan for stopping the transfer of power. The mob and their vile threats. Up to this point, we've shown the inner workings of what was essentially a political coup, an attempt to use the powers of the government from the local level all the way up to overturn the results of the election. Find me the votes, send fake electors, just say the election was corrupt. Along the way, we saw threats of violence. We saw what some people were willing to do. In the service of the nation, the Constitution? No. In service of Donald Trump. When the Select Committee continues this series of hearings, we're going to show how Donald Trump tapped into the threat of violence, how he summoned the mob to Washington, and how, after corruption and political pressure failed to keep Donald Trump in office, violence became the last option. Our investigation is ongoing. Those hearings have spurred an influx of new information that the committee and our investigators are working to assess. We are committed to presenting the American people with the most complete information possible. That will be our aim when we reconvene in the coming weeks. The chair, however, requests those in the hearing room remain seated until the Capitol Police have escorted members from the room. Without objection, the committee stands adjourned.
And with that, day five of the hearings, the public hearings from the House Select Committee investigating the events surrounding January 6th comes to a close. Welcome to the show. I'm Nicole Sandler. What a day it's been. Oh, my goodness. So before we go any further, I think I just need a little palate cleanser, if you don't mind. That was heavy. This morning's Supreme Court ruling was horrendous. I wound up deleting my Twitter account for a few hours because the trolls were swarming, and I'll explain why after. But I guess we can start with this, again, palate cleanser. And this goes out to all the Republicans out there who are so threatened by the thought of a, like a drag story time? Isn't that what they're railing against now? So because of that, a special brand new song from the group Kinsey Six. You ready? Take it away, girls. This goes out to all you Republicans out there who are still behind the biggest con man who ever got one over on this country, and you suckers who bought it. Here we go.
La, 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 la. Votes, Brad, or lose your career. 5,256,000 minutes. One perfect phone call could get him jailed for 10 years. No rallies, tax scamming, no porn stars or pussy grabbing. No groveling by Ted Cruz while he trashes his wife. 525,000 ways he's deep in it. On second thought, let's make it 30 to life. For norms overturned, all the times that he lied. For people he burned, while dry eyes as they died. Corruption will not end. Incarcerate for 30 to life with his treasonous friends, enablers of joy. You gotta remember that love. Do it again and push, comes to shove. The share lies, speak lies, spread lies.
Pressuring on.
Kinsey Six is their name. Treasons of Trump. There you go. I don't know about you, but I really kind of needed that right about now. So a little round of applause for our friends. Kinsey, K-I-N-S-E-Y, Six, S-I-C-K-S. They got a bunch of videos up on YouTube. They are a group of trans women. They're singing in drag. For all you snowflakes out there who can't handle that, that's for you. I hope you enjoyed it. Aren't they talented? It was really good, right? Wow. All right, well, Howie Klein is not here today because the hearing today started at 3 Eastern, and I thought, well, we'll take it through the show. I probably should have said, they'll be done by 5:30. But I already canceled him. So let me tell you about how my day. First, let me start with last night. The concert was amazing. If you get the chance to see Joe Jackson, take it. Because he's one of those really special performers. And I got to tell you, felt right at home. That it was a sold out crowd. And they were all like our age. Because think about it. Joe Jackson's first album, Look Sharp, came out in 1979. And that's when I first just learned of him, saw him that first tour, and I've been a fan ever since. And he just, it's like a fine wine. He gets better with age. When you wouldn't think he could get better, he gets better. So If the tour is coming to you, go. I promise you can thank me later. So last night was wonderful. It was awesome. And then today I get up, I come in here, I start doing my what's news because I start very early in the morning reading everything. And I knew that at 10 o'clock, 10 Eastern, the Supreme Court was going to start announcing their decisions, right? Before today, there were, I believe, 13 still to go. So they gave out five today. And the first four were, as I've been saying, they're all of consequence. They all affect some people. But, you know, there were the handful of the biggies that we're waiting for. And sure enough, the last one they gave today was one of them. It was on that what we've been talking about, a New York law that basically, and I'm oversimplifying everything. I'm not a Supreme Court expert. I'm not a lawyer. I'm just going to give you my layman's interpretation of what we saw. Okay? So basically, a New York law that prevents people from concealed carry, that makes it very, very difficult to get a concealed carry permit. It's really hard to get a gun permit in New York City. Well, the Supreme Court said that their law against concealed carry goes against your Second Amendment right to self-protection. This is opposite world. So basically, no matter where you are, people can... anywhere. You could be on a New York City subway train and you wouldn't know who on that train is carrying. The difference was you didn't know before the people who were carrying were doing it illegally. Now people can do it legally. Doesn't mean because it's legal that it's okay. And it doesn't mean that the person doing it supposedly legally is a good person. By no means does it mean that. So I did what I do. And I went, yes, DC loses their no gun laws too. So I went on Twitter because, you know, I tend to do that. And I tweeted out this morning. Let me read to you the exact tweet that I can tell you is what got the trolls to swarm again to the point where I couldn't block them as fast as they were coming. They must have like a Reddit group or, you know, 4chan or Truth Social where they post a tweet and they go get them. Because within about a minute, it went from nothing to like hundreds of responses where they were all just, where they were all going after me. Like, and so the blocking wasn't happening fast enough. So I wound up deleting my Twitter account. You can do that and you can reinstate it anytime up to 30 days. And I figured it might take a day or two. But I put up a different account so I could at least, you know, read Twitter and send some tweets if one just popped into my brain that I had to get out there. And what I said was something along the lines of, I hope you're watching these hearings. Donald Trump should be tried for treason and hung, because that's the punishment when you're guilty of treason. But Twitter decided that I violated their standards and they blocked me. So Twitter deleted my new account. So I went back in and I reactivated my old one and fuck the trolls. You know why they trolled me? Because I wrote... to the rest of the world, a warning. Do not travel to the United States. American streets are not safe. The Supreme Court just said anyone can carry a concealed gun anywhere, anytime. Don't spend your money here. Your life is at risk the second you deplane. Literally, stay out of the USA. Well, for this, I'm an ignorant bitch and, you know, whatever other words they could come up with. You should see how they piled on. But you know what? This is nothing new. I've been saying this for years. for years. I've been saying that the other countries in the, on this planet should all issue travel advisories, and now more than ever. Now that it's, you know, I was going to say it's the Wild West all over again, except it isn't. Because in the Wild West, it doesn't matter what the movies tell you. The Wild West, if you walked into a town and started, you know, waving your gun around, you'd be in jail. There were very strict gun laws. We don't see them in the movies, but it's true. You couldn't just, you know, ride into town and go in the saloon and start shooting up the place. It was not that free-flowing. But anyway, I started this idea. I wrote an article probably close to 10 years ago. There was an Australian, I want to say tennis player. My details could be off because it's been about 10 years. An Australian, I think, tennis player, college athlete, who was here going to school and playing his sport. And he was in the Midwest somewhere. And when I'm going to play you something, and you'll hear it, and it'll probably explain, but details are foggy. Just go with me on this. He's out. He went out for a run. And there were two or three teenagers who were bored. And so what you wanted, he was baseball. He was a baseball player. Thank you. A long-term loss of short-term memory or something like that. Anyway, he was out for a run, and these teenagers were bored. So they shot and killed him. A student here from Australia, a student athlete, baseball player. Thank you, David. So that's when I first wrote this article saying that other countries should issue travel advisories to their citizens, telling them, don't go to the United States. It's simply not safe to walk down Main Street, any town, USA, because you could get hit by a stray bullet because guns are that rampant here. And the reason I'm saying this is not only to protect the foreign citizens of the world, but I don't want people coming over here and getting killed, but it's also because the only way to get to these Republicans who can affect change is to hit them in the pocketbook. And we have a very healthy tourism industry. Well, maybe that's what needs to be hit. Stop spending your country's dollars here. It's not safe. Period. And for that, I got swarmed on Twitter. Well, you know what? Fuck you, the Twitter trolls. I'm back, bitch. And I thought what I would do, because I didn't have time to pull clips from today's hearings. I'll pull some tomorrow. Tomorrow we have David Dayan from the American Prospect in the second half hour, and I'll get some clips to go over the highlights of today's testimony for the first half hour of the show. But for the time we have left, I want to play for you this interview that I did back in 2014 after that Australian college student baseball player was killed here in the United States by bored teenagers with a gun. And it's with a man named Tim Fischer, who was the deputy prime minister of Australia when they had their one and only mass shooting, a massacre, Port Arthur massacre, I believe it was called. Again, I could be wrong. We'll find out. And so Tim Fischer, a conservative in Australia, helped usher through these new gun laws, and they haven't had another mass shooting since. So this is why I sent out that tweet. And if any of you trolls are listening, listen a little closer. Maybe you'll learn something, you assholes.
Australia had five mass shootings between 1987 and 1996. Then the public decided that was no fun. Parliament passed strict gun laws, and they haven't had a mass shooting since then. Let me repeat that. Australia hasn't had a single mass shooting since the Fresh Prince left Bel Air and was never heard from again.
Okay, so with that, a couple of years ago, following another ridiculous shooting here in the United States of an Australian college student baseball player who was here going to school in Oklahoma, who was shot and killed by three kids who were bored. So they went out and found someone to shoot and kill. I saw an interview with this guy, Tim Fischer. Quick interview on CNN. He is a former deputy prime minister of Australia, was in power in 1996, and was one of the people responsible for ushering in the new gun control laws. And he said something that sparked my interest. I tracked him down. I got him on the air. And, well, this is our conversation. And I hope it's enlightening to you. I think I proposed the one way to make our elected officials pay attention. You hit them in the pocketbook. On the line with us now is Tim Fischer. Tim Fischer is a former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. He's an ex-ambassador, now an author, businessman, and cattle rancher. His latest two books are by ABC Books Australia, Trains Unlimited, and Holy See, Unholy Me, 1,000 Days in Rome. And I guess the latter title comes from your year spent as the ambassador to the Holy See, huh?
Greetings to you, and yes, it does.
I guess I could ask you about the canonization of two former popes, but that's not why I called you today. Tim, I'm so thrilled that you agreed to join us today, because I heard with great interest the interview you did with Piers Morgan following the murder last summer of a young Australian baseball player and college student who was living here in Oklahoma going to school. He was killed by three teenagers who should never have been allowed anywhere near a gun, much less own one, and they said they were simply bored. These kind of things happen with horrible frequency here in the U.S., and I'm of the mind that something needs to be done. Now, you were Deputy Prime Minister in Australia. At the time, there was a horrible massacre, I guess our Newtown massacre that happened last year brought back a lot of memories for the people in Australia over a tragedy that occurred in 1996. Can you tell us what happened then?
Yes, in Tasmania, the state, island state just south of Melbourne, there's a tourist area known as Port Arthur, and it's an old fort and pleasant Sunday afternoon cafe. Up to 100 visitors, when a young man picked up a gun and shot at will until eventually accosted, taking out some 35 people in our worst massacre, the Port Arthur massacre, and one which was the opportunity for Australia to take a decisive turn away from the NRA type policy approach make a difference under the then political leadership of Prime Minister John Winston Howard. Myself as Deputy Prime Minister and many others came on board, including state and federal governments, to make a real difference and make that a turning point.
Now, what were the gun laws like prior to that in Australia?
They were not in harmony. They were somewhat disjointed. Between the states, there was no overall link of computers with regard to gun weapon registration, let alone with regard to shooters' licenses. And so it became quite a chance for those who wanted. It was a laissez-faire approach which allowed the wrong people to have the wrong type of guns. In fact, we had semi-automatics in the suburbs to cut to the chase, and even worse. And therefore, it was crying out for action, and it certainly hit the top of the policy priority list in the aftermath of that dreadful massacre. But even so, there was a lot of pushback and resistance to executing sensible change.
So, but sensible change you made, and then some, because what is it like today in Australia? How often do you see gun murders in Australia these days?
This is why I'm even happy enough to come on board and visit with Mayor Bloomberg's campaign in the Midwest of the USA, in a Montana, or in a Georgia, because it did work. It did make a difference. We have not had, touch wood, one gun massacre, death of four or more, in the in Australia since 1996.
Wow.
It's reached a stage now where you are 15 times or more likely to be shot dead in the USA per million people than here in Australia. Things have, even if there are, sadly there probably will be at some stage, a form of gun massacre it's off a more limited basis because the suburbs have been effectively drained of semi-automatics, and the business of carrying guns into universities, into churches, allowing concealment of guns in some of the states of the USA simply does not exist here in Australia, where our program protects the rights of sporting shooters, protects the rights of cattle ranchers and others to have guns. I have guns. I own guns. But it requires simply a registration of those weapons and a qualification that you are an adequate shooter and that you can have a shooter's license. This is not an imposition. Even if we had a form of the Second Amendment, I would still regard the Australian gun laws as being compliant and successful and protecting gun owners and cattle ranchers to have guns, but stopping massacres, effectively stopping massacres completely.
Right. Again, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Tim Fischer. He's a former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia and was in office when Australia suffered its worst massacre back in 1996 and helped to usher through some common sense gun regulations, and the outcome is tangible. As Mr. Fischer just told us, not a single mass killing, over four people killed since 1996, since those laws were put in place. Now, obviously, you follow what's going on over here in the States, and it's truly sickening. I mean, it's the only way I can describe it. We have an NRA that, while it used to represent, I think, the rights of gun owners, responsible gun owners, now it's more of a lobbying arm for the arms industry, for the gun industry, for gun makers. You know, the propaganda is out of hand. They just had their big NRA convention last weekend, and the bloodlust is almost palpable. And they talk about, you know, the right to bear arms as equated with freedom, without bothering to, you know, note that actually the right to life is I think, more freedom than the right to own a gun. I think the world looked on in horror back in December of 2012 when 20 little first graders were gunned down, were murdered in their classroom, and the six adults who tried to help them. And I thought if anything would make the legislators in this country do something, that would be it. But if that can't motivate them to take action and enact some background checks, some common sense laws, can you imagine anything that would? I mean, what advice can you give us to shake some sense into these people?
It's certainly no excuse to say, look, it's just too hard. We have the Second Amendment, often misinterpreted. We have the safety checks of the Senate and split between the administration and the White House and the U.S. Congress. Therefore, we'll just continue to allow states to pass even more extreme gun laws and just close our eyes to the outcome of that and further shelter more and more into cocoons of safety and ghettoize American society. That's a pathway you can avoid. That's a pathway you need to avoid, in my view. I respect the fundamentals of the U.S. Constitution and the right for the U.S. to choose its path, but it should do so with open eyes. And here in Australia, it was a major political battlefield. I was attacked the length and breadth of the country. I was accused as a Vietnam veteran of letting down the side by supporting sensible gun laws, and I was hung in effigy at a place in Queensland, whilst attending a meeting inside a hall where eventually a 12-year-old high school student stood up and completely nailed the case as to why sensible gun laws make a lot of sense, allowing people of need and people of desire to have guns, but essentially draining the suburbs of their semi-automatics and concealed guns. You are getting to a stage in the USA where Australians should think very carefully about traveling to the USA, traveling to a Georgia or a Montana with their extreme gun laws. And I have publicly advised people here just to weigh the risk factor Yes, there's always risk in travel, period, to any country in the world, period. But the situation with guns on the streets in the USA has reached a tipping point.
And in fact, your warning was the other thing that made me want to reach out to you and track you down, and I'm glad I did, because I heard you in this interview, and here's the quote. You said, "It is another example of murder mayhem on Main Street. People thinking of going to the USA for business or tourist trips should think carefully about it, given the statistical fact that you are 15 times more likely to be shot dead in the USA than in Australia per capita." And here's my thought, Tim. If the massacre of 26 and 7-year-olds in their classroom can't motivate our elected officials or politicians here in the U.S. to take action, I guess the only thing that motivates these people is money. And maybe we need to hit them in the pocketbook. And if we start costing this country, big cities, small cities, tourist attractions, if we start costing tourist dollars, then maybe they'll sit up and take notice. I was thrilled that you said, you know, you warned people they should think twice before coming here. But I think we need to take it a step further. And I know you're no longer in Parliament. You're no longer Deputy Prime Minister. But how can we go about getting countries like Australia, perhaps, you know, England and other countries that have had similar issues? They've been hit by a tragic gun violence massacre incident that made them take action, and things have gotten better. How do we make those countries to take an official stand and really issue a travel advisory warning their citizens against coming here?
The case is building, and it's going to happen sooner rather than later. And when you have the death on a pleasant afternoon of young Mr. Lane, an Australian in the USA, that just nails the case further. So I think there is going to be a dawning of realization, notwithstanding the worst and best efforts of the NRA. And yes, I saw some of the footage from their recent annual meeting. I think people who have brains, who have served in the United Nations as ambassador for the USA, no mean position in the hierarchy of the world, are going to have to look in the mirror and use their brains or face the alternative of a descent into absolute lawlessness. And Mayor Bloomberg deserves credit and others for stepping up to bring pressure to bear to turn the corner, use this tipping point to make a difference before it's too late and before even more people are gunned down unnecessarily. It is sapping the will on the performance and the productivity and the peace of the USA. The NRA has much to answer for.
Oh, absolutely. you nailed it. And again, I can't help but wonder if the Newtown massacre didn't get our politicians to do something, to do anything. Nothing was done in the wake of that. Two mass shootings at Fort Hood, a massacre in a movie theater. It's just the incidents that goes on and on. It is an epidemic. And maybe the only way to get our elected officials to take action is to hit them in the pocketbook to cause
and
financial hardship.
And that is a way forward. But, Nicole, the Washington Post table, looking at arm's length, country by country, just shows how bad it is in the USA versus most other OECD countries. Even Italy is better. It's incredible that where I served as an ambassador, where there's talk of the ongoing existence of the mafia and the Camorra, and yet you are safer Italy than you are in the United States of America, the so-called land of the free.
It is sickening. That chart, by the way, will have in an article that I wrote in the homework section at randyrhodes.com. It's also on my blog at radioornot.com. Tim Fisher, I can't thank you enough. And I'm sure the people of Australia now, almost two decades later, probably many of the same who I can't believe hung you in effigy. How frightening is that? I'm guessing they've come around and realized that you can have common sense laws, regulations, background checks, and still enjoy the freedom of a firearm when necessary, or even for sport, but remain safer in society because of it. Yes?
Nicole, common sense hopefully will eventually prevail because here in Australia, we reached the tipping point, we changed our laws, we harmonized our laws, we protected the rights of people to own guns, but introduced some safety and harmonization that made a huge difference. No gun massacres since 1996. I urge the USA to look closely at the Mayor Bloomberg campaign, related campaigns, and make your streets safe again before it is late. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you very much.
Tim Fisher, he was the Deputy Prime Minister of Australia and helped get sensible gun laws passed after their one and only massacre, the Port Arthur massacre. He has more faith in us than I do. And after today, well, we're fucked, and not in a good way. With that, we're done for today, because I'm done. So tomorrow, David Dayen will be here in the second half hour. First half hour, I'll pull some sound from today, and maybe we'll take some calls, and hopefully the trolls will have gone and fucked themselves into oblivion by then. Or maybe one of them actually heard that interview and understood now where I was coming from. I stand by my tweet. Got it? Good. All right. Well, I'll leave you with the news. It was all done when 10 o'clock hit this morning, and then I'm waiting and listening to the decisions the Supreme Court handed down, and then I had to redo today's What's News, actually just the beginning of it. So this is what I wound up with. I'll see you tomorrow, everyone. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Don't say we didn't warn you. Elections have consequences. Breaking news from the Supreme Court. In a 6-3 ruling written by Clarence Thomas, the Supreme Court now says that the Second Amendment guarantees the right to carry a gun outside of the home, meaning people can now carry a concealed weapon just about anywhere. This case was specific to New York City. Kind of makes moot the so-called gun legislation the Senate is hoping to move today. Before we get to that, though, the court also gutted Miranda rights, basically paving the way for more innocent people to be sent to jail without recourse. I don't know what more there is to say, but I still have some news time to fill, so I'll continue in anger. The House Select Committee, investigating the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, reconvenes Thursday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern for the fifth public hearing. Today, they draw attention to the former guy's effort to use the Justice Department to bolster his attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. So we're told it'll be a deep dive into how Trump pressured DOJ officials to advance what committee members have repeatedly called an attempted coup. They'll show that Trump wanted Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen and Rosen's deputy, Richard Donahue, to cast doubt on the election and give Republican-controlled state legislatures a pretense to appoint alternate presidential electors and prevent Joe Biden's victory. When those top DOJ officials wouldn't do what Trump wanted them to, he threatened to replace them. In response, Rosen, Donahue, and Stephen Engel, who ran a key office inside the DOJ, threatened to resign and implied that they'd take a number of justice officials with them, and then Trump backed down, thankfully averting a constitutional crisis. Well, Rosen, Donahue, and Engel all testified today. These three top officials who led the Department of Justice in the final days of the Trump administration will tell how the former guy and his allies tried to enlist the department to give their baseless fraud allegations credibility.
They'll also make the case that Trump considered replacing the acting attorney general with someone who bought his claims of fraud. Separately, the Justice Department has subpoenaed the Georgia Republican Party chairman for information related to the fake elector scheme. Now, after today's hearing, the committee will take a break from the live public hearings for a few weeks and return with more in July. In the meantime, committee members have received a surge of threats this week, and all of them are expected to be assigned security details. Over the weekend, one of the two Republicans on the committee, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, warned that, quote, there is violence in the future. This after his wife received a written death threat at their home. The Senate is trying to get a gun bill to President Biden's desk before they leave for, another recess for the 4th of July holiday. Today, they're taking a critical vote to move the bill toward final passage. Republican House leaders are, of course, opposing it in lockstep, but some of the members are already on board, and the House is expected to pass it once the bill clears the Senate. Of course, most advocates for tighter restrictions are not real happy about this for a lot of reasons, including the fact that it fails to ban any weapons at all and falls far short of what polls show most Americans want to see. But if it does pass, this would be the most significant new federal legislation to address gun violence since the 10-year assault weapons ban of 1994. And it's nothing. It's nothing. There's no there there. In Uvalde, Texas, the school district police chief, Pedro Arredondo, was finally suspended on Wednesday after weeks of anger rising over his department's botched response to the shooting at Robb Elementary School last month. Arredondo and responding law enforcement agencies have all faced tough criticism over the length of time that the officers waited in the hallway outside the classrooms where this 18-year-old murderer and his victims were located. The gunman fired at officers in the first minute of the incident. Two of them were grazed by bullets, yet more than 70 minutes elapsed before the gunman was shot and killed by officers when they finally stormed the room. This week, the top Texas official in charge of the investigation described the response as, quote, abject failure. So about those gas prices, President Biden on Wednesday urged Congress to suspend federal taxes on gasoline and diesel through September in order to help Americans deal with the high cost. But the plan faces a lot of opposition in Congress. Economists and even some of Biden's fellow Democrats question whether the move would help much. Some progressives, including Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon and Bernie Sanders of Vermont, have been calling for a windfall profit tax on the oil companies who are price gouging. They're making record profits, and they want to take the tax dollars that are going to fund the infrastructure programs that have just been passed into law. Last week, Ron Wyden, who chairs the Senate Finance Committee, floated a 21% surtax on the excess profits of oil and gas companies that generate more than $1 billion in revenue. Wyden saying, quote, our broken tax code is working for big oil, not American families. Well, today is the day that the European Council is expected to accept designating Ukraine as a candidate for membership in the European Union. This kicks off a two-day summit of the leaders of the 27 EU countries who are meeting in Brussels. The European Commission recommended approval of Ukraine's status last week, 4 months after it applied, in a show of support as the country struggles to resist a Russian invasion. Afghanistan, still digging out from a 5.9 magnitude earthquake that hit on Wednesday, the death toll now at least 1,000. Authorities warn it could go a lot higher as rescue crews find survivors trapped in the rubble. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.